Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 34 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my hostess, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing great. Did you have a good holiday?
I had a great holiday.
Really? How was your Wolfanoot?
My what?
Well, you said you had a good holiday. I wanted to know how you celebrated your Wolfanoot.
We didn't have one of those holidays. I didn't know. I don't even know what a wolf of what is.
Wolfanoot. It's actually a thing. I am not pulling your leg. Wolfanoot was created by a 7-year-old boy in New Zealand. And he invented a holiday, which he called Wolfanoot, W-O-L-F-E-N-O-O-T. And according to him, it's when the spirit of the wolf brings and hides small gifts around the house for everyone. People who have had, or are kind to dogs get better gifts than anyone else. You eat roast meat, because wolves eat meat, and cake decorated like a full moon. And it happens on November 23rd of every year. This was the first ever Wolfanoot celebration. And, you know, this being the internet, someone comes up with a wholesome holiday about wolves and therefore dogs, and them being from New Zealand, they don't have a national holiday in November that I know of. And so the internet just went wild over it. And it's actually a thing. There's an official website, there's a Facebook page, there's an event. If people want to buy Wolfanoot themed swag, they can, and the proceeds will go to some sort of animal charity. So it's not like the person is making a profit off of this. It's just all very cute, and I saw all sorts of Wolfanoot themed cakes and such.
Well, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it's very neat.
And here I was, I just ate turkey and some apple pie.
So, did you partake of Black Friday?
I did not. My mother and I walked from South Portland, Maine, into Portland, Maine, over the bridge in sub-zero temperatures, and had breakfast at the local fishing diner, and then walked. My mom did partake in a little bit of Black Friday. There was a place in the old port of Portland called Sea Bags that makes handbags out of sail canvas. And my mom bought a couple. She just bought one. I thought she was going to buy a couple, but she picked the one she liked the most and bought that in their Black Friday sale. So that's what we did.
Sub-zero temperatures?
Yeah. Yeah, we have those.
Huh.
Yeah, the ocean, it was frozen in some places.
Wow.
And the water that isn't part of the ocean, yeah, that was frozen too. That's when the water gets stiff. You know that stuff in your glass? That happens outside.
I know that it gets cold up north. I'm just surprised that it happens before Christmas.
I'm not going to say not usually. It usually gets cold in this. It was actually, it's not snowy here in Massachusetts, but up in Maine, it is super snowy. And as a general rule, Thanksgiving is not. As a matter of fact, my uncle's line when greeting people for Thanksgiving was, Merry Christmas, because it's kind of what it looks like.
Hmm. Well, the furthest north I have ever lived was Washington, D.C., and it was rare for us to get any sort of appreciably cold weather before Christmas. It was usually like January before it started to snow.
And meanwhile, so, I grew up in Maine, where I have climbed over snowbanks to ring a doorbell to go trick-or-treating.
Wow. That sounds like child abuse.
No, man, I got candy. And it's Maine. We're used to it.
Well, then
it just meant that it was that much earlier that I could pull out my sled that I'd been drooling over all summer. you go and grab the rakes in the back of the garage to rake the leaves, and you look up and there's your sled, and you go, not today, but maybe soon. And sometimes it is super soon. It's actually really bad when you get like a big snowstorm before the leaves drop. because it sticks to the leaves, and then those branches come down and they tend to sever power lines.
Now, of course, you grew up in Maine, which is really far north. These days, you live in Massachusetts, which is further south than that. And so I was just surprised to hear that there was snow on the ground in November in Massachusetts. But, you know, as it turns out, there's a lot of other surprising things coming out of Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can go to the show notes and check out the news story that I'm that we were to talk about. But this is just one of those, like, the heartbreak of Massachusetts. So in Massachusetts, as I think those who have been listening to the show long enough should know, but we are one of the few states in the union that requires a permit to own a firearm. And in the case of there used to be multiple different types of permits. Now there's only two. There is the Firearms Identification Card, FID, which is essentially the little stopgap card that I'm sure they're going to try to get rid of for those who are 18 to 20. And so therefore you're not old enough to buy handguns. So that is the permit just for owning long guns, and is generally the youth hunting permit. And then there is the LTC, license to carry, which is our carry permit, of which if you want to own a gun, you apply for the carry permit. And it's hilarious in the fact that I, for, 6 years in the state of Massachusetts, had a license to carry and was not licensed to carry.
Say that again, please, for those of us who didn't quite understand the bullshit the first time.
Yeah, it is that crazy. Permit says license to carry, but at the bottom of my Medford, Massachusetts permit, it was Massachusetts license to carry, and then a big red stamp down at the bottom that said restricted target and hunting only, which meant concealed carry would be illegal. It was literally just my permit to allow me to buy and go to the range or go hunting if I chose to do so in the state of Massachusetts, firearms. So yeah, because that's a thing that happens here. And the overall argument for having restricted permits is that, oh, it allows police to look into someone's background in a way that wouldn't show up in a background check if they know about something. I mean, I can't even BS my way through it too far, because all of that is like, this is all without due process. This is all without the checks and balances of our legal system. You know, I guess if someone allegedly said that, yeah, you're a wicked jerk, they would go, oh, people know you in town as a wicked jerk. I know you've never done anything, and you haven't been certainly haven't been convicted of anything, but because you are a alleged wicked jerk, I'm going to put a restriction on your permit, which that in itself is awful, but that in itself also does not happen. People do not get restrictions because of something. No, you get a restriction because of where you live. You either live in a town like the one I live in now, and when I was shopping for a house, I told my wife, we are only buying a house in one of these towns because I don't want to be treated like a criminal. There's a town right next to me that, yep, you go in for a permit and they will put a restriction on it, because they put a restriction on everybody's permit unless you can grease their skids a certain way. If you know somebody who's going to make a stink if you tick me off, or if I bribe you outright. I don't know if anyone's been caught bribing someone, but it happens in New York. I'm sure it happens here. But as a general rule, say in the city of Boston, the people who have unrestricted permits are much like the people who have concealed carry permits in New York City. You'd recognize who they are. They're all people of prominence.
So a lot like in New York City, where the carry permit is basically a reward for political favors done.
Correct. Political favors done, or just having enough social clout that denying you could make it painful for them. So exactly. So that's one of the reasons why I became such a gun nut, is I walked in and didn't even speak to a uniformed officer. I don't think this person was a sworn peace officer. I think she was just a secretary. And she outright told me, no, we're not going to give you a concealed carry permit. I didn't even introduce myself. Didn't even know my name. They just literally said, we don't issue those. This leads us to this court case that we're going to be discussing. There was a court case done where a group of people who had their permits restricted for reasons that they could not fathom challenged it in court, saying, geez, that's unconstitutional. You're saying that I can own a handgun, I can carry a handgun on my property, but I cannot step out into public with this handgun, even though I've passed the background check, I've gone through the training course, I've paid a lot of money. And the court deemed that, and this is the Court of Appeals, so the courts have multiply deemed that perfectly constitutional.
Yeah, the rationale, I guess, is, well, like Liberty Doll said, because some people are getting their permits, it's not being restricted.
Mm. I mean, that's the anti-gunner argument, is people talk about, like, we say, oh, in England, they've got, you know, no Second Amendment rights whatsoever. And then the anti-gunners say, well, no, if you go through all these crazy hoops, then you can have this minimal selection of guns that you can own in England. So therefore, no, they can own guns in England. Yeah.
Or a little more closer to home, when states like Massachusetts and California restrict the kinds of firearms citizens can buy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it's not infringing on your Second Amendment rights. After all, you can still buy guns.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, according to this logic, you know, they could rule that the only thing you are allowed to carry is, a 25 caliber Jennings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, we're letting you carry that. We aren't restricting your Second Amendment rights. But it's a piece of shit. Doesn't matter. That's a gun you can buy. Yep. You aren't restricted.
I actually bought a Jennings just because you can't buy them in Massachusetts. Oh, it's so aggravating that that's going on. I mean, they're going to keep going. Hopefully, they're going to push this up to the Supreme Court. I will have you know that I have had the fortune to share beers with Alan Gura, and oh my God, it's like one of the high points of my life is hanging out with Alan Gura. And that was one of the questions I asked him, was, yeah, Massachusetts permit system. He's like, oh yeah, no, totally unconstitutional. I mean, this is again on the restrictions, not the permits themselves. And again, if I want to buy a box of 22, I didn't say I had a gun. I just want to buy a box of 22. I need to have a permit for me to have guns. I need to have a permit. And the permit is a pain in the butt and getting worse. I will say right now, at the time of our recording, I am probably, while you're hearing it, it's going to keep going on, I'm in the process of renewing my permit. And it is just miserable. And they've added new questions on there. Like, I had to go dig up my old, and thankfully I'm a pack rat. I've got a little stack on my desk of all my old permits. I had a Maine and a New Hampshire carry permit, and I've let them expire since both states have gone constitutional carry. And I'm just like, yeah, I'll save my money for other things. Yeah. They wanted to know, like, all of my other permits that I have ever had. And so I had to go dig up my two expired permits. They said including expired, and I'm just like, really, what are we doing here? One of them was with my Florida permit, which is insanely easy. It's great. You fill out a form, and it's not as easy as the New Hampshire one. The New Hampshire one was why bother, which is why I'm glad they've gone to constitutional carry. But Florida is perfectly reasonable. Yeah, you get your fingerprints done, they take your picture, away you go. You pay your fee, away you go, and it's good for 7 years. I love it.
So, Weird, why is Massachusetts like this? Because I can sort of understand New York, because the big honking New York City with all the crime. And I can understand California, because you've got L.A. and the other big metroplexes with all the crime and the gang activities. But While I acknowledge that Boston is a big city, it's not a big city the way that, you know, Chicago, New York, LA are. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is it like those other states where the rest of the state is controlled by the tyranny of the big city, or is there something cultural within Massachusetts itself?
I would say it's probably the cultural angle of it. I mean, it's one of those, I can't buy a cold beer in the grocery store. Here's the really amusing thing. When I first moved to Massachusetts, I could not buy a cold beer in the grocery store. Or as someone who frequently braises meat and beer because it's delicious, if I was picked up some meat and went, oh, this would be great braised in beer, I would need to make a separate stop at a separate store to pick up a beer. You can only buy alcohol in liquor stores. There has since been a little loophole, or I don't even know if it's a loophole, but now there have been liquor stores opening up inside of stores. So it's kind of like the Vatican City inside of Rome. I'll actually walk through a separate set of doors inside my grocery store into another store. There'll be an entirely different lady standing behind a cash register, and I will pick up beer and give it to her. And she's like, do you want your receipt? I said, yeah, I think I should have my receipt just in case someone questions me as I walk out of the store. And she goes, they're not going to care. They don't sell beer. If you're trying to shoplift beer out of the store, the store itself isn't going to stop me. That's the liquor store's problem. It's just, we've got insane amounts of taxes. We've got all sorts of just crazy restrictions on everything. So why not do it with guns? It's generally a very gun unfriendly state. There's lots of gun people here. I feel like there's plenty of gun nuts here in Massachusetts, but I think that's the fact that I'm kind of in a self-selecting circle. They tend to find me and I tend to look for them. So I think that's just it. 'Cause I mean, when you look at New England, you've got Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, all some of the most gun-friendly places. I would argue that New Hampshire is the most gun-friendly place in the universe because we haven't discovered any other planet that allows people to have guns. It's certainly more friendly than any place on this planet. And you suddenly get into Massachusetts and there's the restrictions. Rhode Island has got all sorts of horrible restrictions. Connecticut has all sorts of horrible restrictions. And then you're all abutting New York. So I think it's really kind of that gradient of New York.
Well, as David has made it very clear, New York City is the source of a lot of anti-gun evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's really is. It's kind of a brain trust for anti-gun laws. California and New York and Chicago, most of the bad ideas for gun control are spawned out of those places.
And if I recall my history correctly, I believe the restriction on firearms ownership it's either New York or Chicago, and I think it's New York, goes back to the Sullivan Act.
That's New York, yeah.
And, okay, you're more familiar with this than I am. The Sullivan Act was actually cronyism, wasn't it?
I believe it's alleged, though I'm firmly in the camp that it was, that Sullivan himself was an actual gangster. And the whole point of the Sullivan Act was, yeah, you needed a permit to carry weapons in New York, and the permits were issued by the police, and they were may issue. So Sullivan and all of his gang guys would all get their permits. It's kind of like that scene in The Untouchables where the assassin's right there in the courthouse and Elliot Ness goes and stops the guy and he pulls out a gun permit and he's a gangster and he's there to kill somebody. But he's got the permit because he's got the juice with the government. Sullivan had the juice with the government. Some of the other gangs didn't have the juice with the government. And so they were at a disadvantage.
I think what distresses me most about the situation in Massachusetts is that Massachusetts is touted as being the birthplace of American democracy. And it seems like it's going to be both the cradle and the grave of freedom. And you know, I can tolerate it in a lot of other places, but this is the state where the Revolutionary War is held in almost religious fervor. and you fight a war with guns. And the Revolutionary War got started when the British decided to disarm some people, and they said, no, we're not going to let you disarm us, and they killed them with guns. And
the image of the Minuteman is used on all sorts of stuff all over the state. And while still in Massachusetts, as of the time of this recording, don't hold your breath, you can buy a flintlock musket just the same as any other place. There's no restrictions on them. But if you want powder and balls, you're going to at least need an FID.
Yeah. See, that's really what bothers me. It's I could take it from a lot of different places, but not from Massachusetts. And it seems hypocritical and not respectful of y'all's history.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is weird because I think I've said before, I grew up anti-gun. I was 19 when I fired my first shot and started having my mind changed. So I was well an adult before I started really supporting gun rights. And I specifically say gun rights because I always understood the Second Amendment because, yeah, we took field trips to look at graves of British soldiers. It was just the natural thing is, yeah, we killed those people. Grew up in Portland. Portland got burned down. The Revolutionary War is very real here in New England. And yeah, to have them just go, oh yeah, but we're the good King George.
Ow.
All right. So since I am getting depressed at this, but let's get depressed on a different level. On the subject of other restrictions that make no sense and infuriate us all to no end, Oddball gives us a brief primer on some of the more insane knife laws in the United States.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. Since I'm recording this over Thanksgiving weekend, I figured I'd talk about something that I'm thankful for. Namely, that I live in a state with sane knife laws. We have a state preemption, so local municipalities can't pass silly laws on their own. And the only restrictions that we have are you can't carry a knife in certain controlled spaces, like airports and courthouses, and using a switchblade in the commission of a crime is extra illegal. This wasn't always the case. It wasn't that long ago that it was illegal to carry a knife with a blade longer than 4 inches, and all automatic knives were illegal. Add to that we didn't have a preemption law, and cities could have further restrictions. For example, some cities had ordinances against carrying hawkbills, daggers, and other scary blades. Unfortunately, not everyone is as lucky. Just as gun owners have to deal with gun laws that may or may not make sense, and can be significantly different depending on where you're standing, so do knife owners. One thing that seems to be common is restrictions on blade length. As I said, where I live, it used to be illegal to carry a knife with a blade over 4 inches. In practice, this wasn't really an issue, as there are a ton of knives out there that are under this limit, and frankly, anything larger than that is not particularly convenient to have in your pocket. Of course, being told that I couldn't carry anything larger always kind of bugged me. Even then, I was still lucky. There are a lot of states where the blade limit is 3 inches, and there are some places like Chicago where it's illegal to carry anything over 2 inches in length. The theory behind these blade restrictions is that knives over this length are somehow evil and will predominantly be used in crime. Of course, this requires you to ignore the knives that most folks have in their kitchen that reach 8, 9, or 10 inches. To add to the confusion, there are a few states that state that it's illegal to carry a blade of a certain size, quote, with the intent to go armed, which, in practice, tends to mean if the cops like you or not. There's also a few states that have restrictions on the type of knives you can carry. A number of states ban the carrying of fixed blade knives, unless if you're involved in an activity like camping. Others ban things like knives with both edges sharpened, because they're classified as daggers. And again, daggers are apparently more evil than other knives. Of course, there's a lot of places that still have bans on switchblades and other automatic knives. These laws were in response to hysteria in the 1950s. The media and press pushed the idea that switchblades were evil weapons that were especially deadly, and the choice of gangs and other criminals all over the country. Gun owners probably find that statement extremely familiar. I'm sure you won't be shocked to find that reality had nothing to do with the narrative. There's some other laws that knife owners have to deal with that are about as clear as mud. An example is a law in Kentucky that only allows its citizens to conceal carry, quote, ordinary pocket knives or hunting knives. Now, what constitutes an ordinary pocket knife is anyone's guess. Oh, and if you spotted that I used the term conceal carry, good job. Yes, there are some jurisdictions that actually care how you carry a knife. Some get angsty if you're carrying it concealed. Some care if you carry it openly. Some get so angsty about open carry that there are folks that actually make lanyards that have pocket clips that look like the tops of pens so that you can attach it to your knife and be able to easily access your knife without using the pocket clip that's probably already on the knife, because having the knife's pocket clip showing might count as open carry and therefore possible jail time. Of course, there's some states where some of the laws don't apply to folks with carry licenses. And then there are places like New York City. F**k New York City. Seriously, the state is bad enough. The state bans knives with knuckle guards, knives that are disguised as other things, including sword canes, switchblades, knives that they decide are primarily used as weapons, gravity knives, and butterfly knives. Oh, and if you're not a U.S. citizen, yeah, you're not allowed to carry any knife. New York City has to take it further. New York City says that you have to completely conceal any knife you carry. That means no pocket clips. It also means the little micra that dangles on my keychain is also illegal. On top of that, the New York PD has decided that a gravity knife means any lock blade knife that the officer can open through the use of inertia. This includes grabbing the knife by the blade and flinging it around. By this definition, almost all lock blades are gravity knives. It's to the point that when I visited the Beretta store in New York City a few years back, I asked the nice salesperson what knives in their case were actually legal to carry in New York. She couldn't give me a clear answer. The good news is there is a group fighting all this BS. The folks over at kniferights.org are a great group of folks that have been doing good work. They're the reason my state has the laws that we currently enjoy, and they've been fighting in other parts of the country. They've even been fighting the good fight in New York, both in the legislature and in the courts. If you have some money left over after donating to your chosen pro-gun groups, I highly recommend sending them some money. I also need to put the usual I am not a lawyer stamp on this. As you can see, knife laws are all over the place, so please do your own research. I highly recommend Knife Up's page on knife laws as a starting point, and we'll include a link in the show notes. Oh, and don't be terribly surprised if a cop tells you that the law is something that just isn't true. I've heard countless stories of, well, a police officer told me, and that law just didn't exist. Well, after talking about this stupidity, I think I'm going to go back to enjoying good company and maybe a few drinks. If you would like to read more of my thoughts, I write at gunscarstech.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for further segments, feel free to send me an email at oddball@gunscarstech.com or give me a shout on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
I mean, this is something that I think needs to be talked about more in the Second Amendment groups. I mean, I think it's not underspoken about. This isn't really, I'm not admonishing anybody, because really when you hang out with a bunch of gun nuts, you're also hanging out with a bunch of knife nuts. And
Oh geez. I'm trying to remember if it was the NRA up in, oh gee, was it Indianapolis? Was it Kentucky? When you and I and a bunch of people and Anthony Welsh from Lucky Gunner, we went out to dinner, and I think someone needed a knife for something, and then just, you know, hands went into pockets and a cutlery store materialized.
Oh yeah, that's something that happens like all the time in like gun nut gets togethers, especially if you're having just like a dinner, and especially not an open carry dinner where, come on, we got to do a little displaying and all that, is someone will just say, all right, everybody, put your knives on the table. And yeah, there, a lot of knives suddenly show up. But knives are arms. Like the Second Amendment is frequently deemed the gun amendment by a lot of people in the common vernacular, but it's not just that. I mean, knife laws are Second Amendment laws as well.
All right, so I completely agree with you. You will get no argument from me. I think the difference in people's minds comes from the fact that guns are used only to shoot, whereas knives are seen as tools because, yes, you use them to cut, but you use them to cut all sorts of things. When you think of a pocket knife, your first thought is not, I will use this to stab someone. Mm-hmm. It's more of, I will use this to open packages. I will use this to cut the string off my clothes. I will use this to cut my meat if necessary. Yes, it is a weapon, but it's a tool. And okay, we can get into that whole weapons are tools, tools are weapons, but a knife is far more utilitarian. I use knives way more often and on many different things than I use a gun for. So I think that it is worth repeating that knives are arms because people don't think of them that way.
No, that's true. Though I gotta say, when I first switched off from marine biology into the pharmaceutical industry, I started working at a small biotech company, and I mean, there was maybe 30 some employees there, and I was the dude that carried a knife, and I was also the dude that was carrying a gun, but no one seemed to figure that out. But I was the dude that carried a knife. So people would go, oh, I got this package. Hey, weird. Can you get your knife? Can you open this package for me? And I'd be like, yeah, sure. And I'd pull out my knife and flick it open and start to open the package. And it seemed like there was a couple of people there that no matter what, they would ask me, can you open this for me? And they would be looking at my knife, you know, clipped in my pocket. And I would pull the knife out. And as soon as that blade would come out, suddenly their eyes would get big and they'd kind of step back and they'd get smaller. And it just was one of those like the what are you fearing on that? And I guess that's also going on your angle is there are some people that only see knives as weapons. And again, I was like the only dude that was carrying a knife. Like it wasn't like, oh yeah, no, me and a couple other people. And so, yeah, it was all that. No, like 99% of these people who are opening boxes all day long didn't have a knife on them. And
they didn't even have box cutters.
I mean, there's box cutters, and a lot of them would do the open up the scissors and use the scissors to cut stuff. And I hate when people do that. Oh, that's just, you know, there's one thing of using the scissors as the right tool and using knives as scissors. And I mean, I do that all the time, but the using a scissors as a knife. Oh, that's miserable work.
Well, and we aren't even getting into the whole using fabric scissors to cut paper.
Oh,
so, yeah, I just had this image of someone using, you know, the fabric scissors to open a package, and no, sorry, here's your coffin. You're going to die.
Yeah, my wife was doing some sewing the other day, and I picked up her fabric scissors that she hadn't quite put away yet, and I went to go cut coupons, and she was throwing daggers at me. I would never have done it. I would have never done it. But just the sheer pantomime of doing it.
You like to live dangerously, my friend.
It supplies a certain amount of spice to life. A joie de vie, if you will.
But yes, bringing this back on topic, knife rights is basically the NRA for knives. And they definitely deserve our support, especially considering some of the really ridiculous knife laws out there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Oddball covered the really heinous ones. I remember one from my first GRPC, and there was a lawyer whose name I had forgotten, but he works for knife rights, and he was talking about just how fickle these laws are. He told a story about talking to a police officer and saying, is this knife legal? And the police officer took it, and he could not open it one-handed, and so he declared it was legal. And then the guy handed it to his partner, who was able to open it one-handed, and somehow this legal knife became illegal like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if that isn't just a textbook example of, what, fickleness? Uneven application of the law? There's a technical term here that I'm missing. But let's just go with rampantly unfair.
And can we just go on the dumb level of the, what's the point of having a knife that you can't open with one hand? You pick up something and go, oh, I need to cut this or open this. But now you've got to set it down so that you can open your tool to cut and open it?
So I crap you negative, my friend. There is a particular line of knives. It might be Spyderco for some reason. I don't know why I'm thinking of that. But it's marketed as being safe for various places like New York. And it is your regular pocket knife, except it doesn't lock. And there's actually a little concave space for you to put your index finger in order to keep the blade in place. And the idea is, okay, with the finger pressing up, you can use the blade sort of as a tool, but you definitely can't stab with it.
Or as I could see it, Error, we've made the knife less safe so that you can enjoy it. That's like the laws that mandate you have a magazine disconnecting your gun. Ugh, congratulations. More people are going to be injured and hurt because of this safety feature. Thanks.
Last week, Weird fisted the Young Turks as they all crapped their collective panties over the NRA updating fairy tales with armed protagonists. The self-soiling hysteria continues this week over guns being made to kill.
Last week, I was fisking this clip of the Young Turks. They were railing against a short-lived NRA program where they presented classic fairy tales and how they might go if the children that were befallen by the various boggarts and beasties were armed. I covered all the talk of kids and guns in last week's episode, but this week I'm covering their quick degeneration to anti-gun strawman arguments. But in the weird audio fisks, the strawmen fight back.
Weapons that have been created to kill, that's the only thing that guns do, they kill, okay? Anyone who argues against that, I don't know which world you're from.
This is Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks, and she is throwing out a common anti-gun argument. So I suspect that most of you have the same initial reaction as I do. I own a lot of guns, and personally, I have only killed a handful of prairie dogs with a firearm in my life. And that was a borrowed rifle. I have killed nothing with any of my personal guns. But every single one of my guns, from my diminutive 25 ACP pocket guns to my shotguns and rifles, are all potentially deadly. All guns being potentially deadly isn't really that grave a statement, as I could say that about most power tools, kitchen knives, and all automobiles. And while we might want to argue that an uber-expensive skeet gun or a presentation-grade 1911 or an Olympic-style target pistol are very unlikely to be used to kill, the potential is there, and that is a pitfall to that argument. Because in the end, sporting and collecting arms are a frivolous thing. As much as you might want a Cabot Arms 1911 or a Holland & Holland double rifle, you don't need those things. And as much meat as your grandfather's Winchester Model 70 has put on the table, these days with hunting regulations, it's generally cheaper and easier just to go buy some beef or chicken at the grocery store. But the pistol concealed under your coat when you're assaulted, or the rifle by your bed when your door gets kicked in, are very much needed. And given the number of potential spree killers stopped in their tracks by armed citizens who could respond immediately to the threat while others waited for the police, they are things that are very much needed. And while it's the Bill of Rights, not the Bill of Needs, the life and death nature of defensive firearms makes it a very powerful argument. So my response to this argument is, yes, guns are meant to kill, and they are the best tool for the horrible events when killing another person is both legally justified and morally imperative. The root of Ms. Kasparian's statement is something that goes against human nature. America may be an outlier in the freedom that we grant the average citizen to go about armed. We are not any different than any other country in the entire world when it comes to killing in self-defense or the defense of others. Even in the United Kingdom, with some of their Catch-22 self-defense laws, it is still legally justifiable killing another human being when life and limb are on the line. the argument against firearms simply because they can be used to kill is really an inhuman argument, because as humans, we believe that murderers and rapists should be killed rather than allowing them to complete their crimes.
And this is the same NRA that is vehemently against smart guns, which basically make sure that the owner is the only person who can fire off a gun. It has special sensor technology.
This is Jordan Cheriton, and he is making a straw man argument. The NRA is not against smart gun technology. The NRA is against laws that make smart guns mandatory. In New Jersey, there's already a law that states that once a smart gun is commercially available, all other firearms will be illegal. So that's a terrible law on many levels. But while Jordan speaks with such authority on smart gun technology, this New Jersey law is not in effect, despite it being passed back in 2002, because there are no commercial smart guns in existence. He could talk all he wants about sensors and widgets. Currently, they are all speculations, as nobody has found a way to get this crap to work.
Which would prevent a lot of mass shootings where kids steal their parents' guns.
Again, said with a lot of authority, but from a position of total ignorance. The only smart guns that have existed in the market are simply guns that need to be in proximity with an unlocking device. The one that made the most news was the Armatrix IP1, which was a .22 pistol that, as far as I could tell from reviews, didn't really work very well. But its smart technology was a wristwatch that communicated with the gun with a radio signal. And you needed to wear this watch on your shooting hand. I don't know about you, but I wear my watch on my left wrist. And with the prevalence of smartwatches this day, this would require you to wear a watch on both wrists. Essentially, this RFID watch is no different than my Smith & Wesson revolvers that have an internal key lock. Only the key and the gun both require batteries. Does that sound very smart to you? If someone's going to steal the gun, they could probably steal the key. And if you want to take measures to make sure that they don't steal the key, you can probably do all of this with conventional trigger locks and gun safes. But the New Jersey law has added the bonus of banning guns, which is the entire endgame for so-called gun violence prevention. They don't like you calling them gun banners, because that's true.
The NRA's against that.
Why would they be against that?
This is a failing of the anti-gun side. They often speak from a position of total ignorance. I've seen many an anti-gunner brag with pride that they know nothing of guns, and have heard them brag that they are proud that they have never even touched a real gun. Also, while they're always preaching new laws, they seem comically unaware of the current laws. He asks, why would the NRA oppose this? As he talks about smart guns that don't actually exist, but he gives the impression that they do exist. He's phrasing that question as rhetorical, but really, he shouldn't be asking it for effect. He should be asking the internet, or people he knows who own guns. Not that I suspect he knows any of those. And we should be careful to not fall into the same trap. That's one of the big reasons why I do this segment.
Why are they against armor-piercing bullets? Like, they're against all sorts of things that make sense.
Against preventing armor-piercing bullets.
They're pro-armor-piercing.
Now, this question was not presented as rhetorical. And boy, Cenk Unger's answer is laughable.
The NRA wants you to be able to buy bullets that are specifically designed to kill cops. Because, I don't know if you know this, the deer do not have armor.
He's right. Deer don't wear body armor. And cops do wear armor. Generally, police wear soft body armor that is rated for pistols and shotgun rounds. Do you know what police body armor is useless against? Rifle ammo, as in the same stuff that people shoot those unarmored deer with. And this is why the NRA and anybody with a brain in their head is opposed to armor-piercing bullet laws. Because most of the common rifle rounds in America will sail right through the vest worn by your standard beat cop. There's also a larger risk to armor-piercing ammo bans. Some states have banned lead ammo for environmental reasons. Never mind that elemental lead is fairly inert. Most of the harmful lead exposure comes from exposure to lead vapor at the shooting range, not the lead in the berm, and from lead-containing compounds like lead paint or lead gasoline. Moreover, often they will circumvent the clearly insane classification of armor piercing by specifying rounds that use a core of metal harder than lead as AP ammo. Except if you ban the use of lead ammo, people turn to copper ammo. And while copper ammo is not armor piercing, I've never seen legislation in any way that would make that distinction. So those two laws put together ban all ammo. And we have all heard anti-gunners saying in frustration, if we can't ban guns, why not ban ammo?
You don't need no gun control. You know what you need? We need some bullet control.
We need to control the bullets. That's right. I think all bullets should cost $5,000. $5,000 for a bullet. You know why? Because if a bullet costs $5,000, there'll be no more innocent bystanders.
So yeah, a lead ammo ban plus an armor-piercing ammo ban, either by declaring anything that can bust a 2A vest a cop killer, or declaring non-lead ammo AP no matter how terminally it performs, it could mean that you might have all the guns in the world and nothing to feed them.
We're going to squeeze every cent we can. If that means more cops are killed, great, I made an extra buck. That's how we design these out-of-control corporations, right? And then we let them buy our government, so we can't even do anything about them.
Yep, gun companies are just tickled pink of cops getting killed. Also ironic that they're saying that the NRA is buying the government. Well, clearly the fight for the Second Amendment is over, because Michael Bloomberg is outspending the NRA. Either Cenk is full of it, or we're going to be turning in our guns really soon. What do you think?
You think they don't want the bad guys to have guns? The bad guys pay even more money. They got to pay the guy who's buying it, quote unquote, legally for them and then giving it to them. That guy's going to make money in the meanwhile, but more guns are going out. Of course they want the bad guys to have guns. That means they sold more guns.
But after the alleged straw buyer gets the gun companies see no further money from it. Even when I walk into a gun shop and buy a used gun, the gun companies make nothing from that. Of course, I say alleged because when criminals are actually interviewed in prison, they aren't buying it through some direct connection to the gun stores. They're getting guns, and generally old guns, through friends and others in the criminal world. When you look at ATF trace data, the time to crime numbers are measured in years, because very few people are buying guns in bulk to sell on the streets. The people who are so easily caught that it hardly makes it a business model.
And it's because I'm going to say we have a neutral media which allows our government to be bought. And our government is bought. So after Sandy Hook shooting, 90% of the people in America wanted some kind of gun legislation. We didn't get it. Why? Because they only respond to donors, not voters. And that's what Bernie Sanders is here to overturn.
Except for that whole ballot initiative thing. Unfortunately, in the midterm elections, Washington Initiative 1639 passed, but it was only a 60-40 margin, and the anti-gun corporate lobby outspent the NRA by orders of magnitude. And those are wide margins as far as anti-gun ballot initiatives go. Outside of anti-gun deep blue states, they fail and fail hard, despite huge money coming in from the corporate anti-gun lobby. So how does that fit with your little worldview? Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
So every time someone has a fit over guns are made only to kill, I mean, my thoughts are always, well, yes, duh, that's why we give them to the army and to the police.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you acting like this is at all unusual?
And again, as I said in the Fisk, I looked far and wide. I've actually asked people, and again, if you're listening to this, if you can find me a location on the globe where using deadly force to stop loss of life or limb is outright illegal, I would love to hear about it, because I am not aware. There's a whole bunch of just third world dumps, but there's in their law, they can defend their lives.
Okay, Weird, I'm actually going to have to burst your bubble here. All right, maybe there isn't a law that specifically says self-defense is illegal, but this happened earlier this month in Saudi Arabia. Earlier this month, Saudi Arabia executed an Indonesian maid, and the reason they killed her is because her employer was raping her, and she killed him in self-defense.
Ugh.
Now, it may be because of Saudi Arabia's terrible rules regarding women, and maybe if it had been a man, it would have been okay, but unfortunately, it's very real.
I hadn't really thought about that, and yeah, I believe Saudi Arabia does have deadly force laws on the books as well. They are not necessarily equally distributed. I think that solidifies my argument. Is that what level you want to be at? Of the we allow use of deadly force in this country. Do you want to handicap the people defending their lives and stopping rapists? that's very similar to the common anti-gun argument of the, oh, we have restrictions on the magazine size of hunting guns. And I point out, yeah, that's so that we don't wipe out all the ducks and deer. That's to give, you know, the animals a fighting chance so that there'll be more stuff for future generations. So you want muggers and rapists and murderers for future generations? I'd be perfectly comfortable wiping them off the face of the earth.
Have you ever thought about reloading ammunition? Are you curious about how difficult it is or what tools and supplies are required? Fear not. David is here to give you a beginner's guide on how to reload ammo.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to discuss metallic cartridge reloading. Obviously, this isn't going to be an in-depth discussion of all the details involved in the reloading process, but more of a general primer. I may go into more detail in future segments. Reloading enables you to shoot more for the same expenditure of money. For example, if you're spending $100 a month on practice ammunition, that money would go much further if spent on reloading supplies. By the way, if anyone tells you that reloading will save you money, they're trying to sell you something. Now, I don't count my time reloading when calculating the amortization of investment in equipment and supplies because, to me, reloading is fun. Based on my current setup, I can reload 45 ACP for about 15 cents a round or less than $8 for a box of 50. In comparison, a box of Tula steel-cased 45 ACP goes for around $14 per box of 50. The equipment needed to start reloading need not be either extensive or expensive. A basic single-stage press, dies, shell holder, balance scale, and calipers is really all the equipment you need to begin. Nor does a reloading setup need to take up much space. Other than the press, all the other components can fit in a small tub that can be stored in the closet when not in use. The consumables are brass, bullets, primers, and powder. Brass you should be able to save as you go, and straight wall pistol brass can be reloaded many times, unless you're loading to maximum pressure. Also, ask your friends who don't reload to save their brass for you. What calibers you don't shoot, you can use and trade with other reloaders. Cast or plated bullets are less expensive than jacketed and are fine for target shooting. Primers and powder can usually be sourced at a local gun show or retailer. If not, then you'll need to order them online. This will be more expensive because of the hazardous materials fee that the shippers require. This fee is usually around $20 per order. To reload a metallic cartridge, whether rifle or pistol, certain steps must be taken. Starting with a clean fired case, it needs to be deprimed, resized, flared or belled, primed, powder added, bullet seated, crimped, and finally checked. I'll review each of these steps in turn. Depriming is the removal of the old primer so that the case can be reused. Depriming may be done before or after case cleaning. If done after cleaning, depriming is usually combined with resizing of the case. I'll talk about this step more in a moment. If depriming is done before cleaning, a universal depriming tool is generally used. This is much like a standard depriming die, except it only pushes out the old primer and doesn't touch the case itself. Resizing is done after the case is cleaned to prevent damage to the case and the die from small particles of dirt and debris. When a case is fired, it expands to seal the chamber and prevent the expanding powder gases from flowing into the gun's mechanism or back at the shooter. After the bullet leaves the barrel and pressure drops, the case springs partially back to its original size. Resizing squeezes the case back to starting size based on recognized standards. These standards are maintained by the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute, or SAMI. With bottleneck rifle cases, this step can also be used to bump the shoulder back if that's deemed necessary. If the rifle case will be fired in the same rifle, minimal resizing is done to avoid overworking the case. Case flaring, or belling, is a slight widening of the case mouth to ease insertion of a bullet. Depending on whether you're using jacketed or lead bullets determines the type and amount of case flare that's needed. This step can occur before or after priming, and can also be combined with powder dispensing. Priming is the insertion of a new primer in the case. This can be done either on a press or with a hand tool. Either way, you need to pay special attention to make sure the primer is seated properly to prevent potentially dangerous issues. At this point, it's time to dispense powder. Prior to this step, an appropriate powder would have been chosen and the proper weight or volume determined. Always check your chosen powder in at least two recent reloading manuals for your starting load. Bullet seating is, as the name implies, placing a bullet in the belled mouth of the case and pressing it into the proper depth. Overall cartridge length, or OAL, is an important measurement and should be checked with a caliper based on the entry for that cartridge with that bullet weight and style in your reloading manual. Crimping is the removal of the flare that was added in an earlier step. Depending on the type of cartridge, either a roll crimp or a straight crimp will be used. Roll crimping actually curls the case over and slightly into the bullet to help hold everything in place. This type of crimp is most commonly found in revolver cartridges. In the rifle world, the roll crimp is also frequently used on any cartridge that might be loaded in a tubular magazine. Straight crimping is more common in cartridges designed for semi-automatic firearms and involves ironing out the crimp so the case mouth is parallel with the bullet. At this point, your cartridge is complete and ready for firing. Testing is recommended when you are assembling a new load for the first time or are loading from once-fired brass that didn't get shot in your firearm. This testing can take the form of measuring with calipers, using a chamber gauge, or, in the case of handguns, something called the plunk test. The plunk test consists of field stripping your semi-automatic pistol, holding the barrel muzzle down, and gently dropping the loaded case into the chamber. It should seat to the proper depth with no effort and make a soft plunk sound as it drops into the chamber. Then, invert the barrel and the loaded cartridge should drop straight out with no sticking. If the case doesn't seat to proper depth or sticks when you invert the barrel, it means the case is slightly oversized and you may need to refine your die adjustments. Once you've gotten comfortable with these steps, you should be able to crank out practice ammunition at a reasonable rate. If the idea of loading your own ammunition interests you, but you're not sure you want to make a large investment in equipment up front, you should be able to find reloading equipment used either on various firearm discussion boards or online auction sites. I created a series of videos that show these steps, and I'll ask our hosts to include the link in the show notes. Happy reloading. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Now, I like how David doesn't even try to claim that reloading will save you money like a lot of people say. No, he flat out admits that you will shoot more for the same amount and may even shoot more in general.
Yeah, I found that when I switched over to reloading, I went from spending, you know, a few bucks at the gun shop to buy a few boxes of ammo on my way to the range, and then to going buying huge bulk amounts, buying thousands of components in one sitting and writing these like big checks that hurt. But I was shooting a lot more bullets for the same amount of money.
The biggest problem I have with reloading is the initial outlay. Mm-hmm. In terms of you have to get all the gear, and then I know David said it doesn't require a whole lot of space. I have trouble finding a space for the press, and then just, all right, where am I going to store it? I live a very cramped life, and it's one of the things that I would love to get into, but I also know my psychology, and if I do it, I would want to spread out and have my own little workspace, and I don't have that yet. Maybe someday.
Yeah, I ended up going to a thrift shop and for $25 bought a pine school desk. That is my reloading bench. And just I've got my two presses bolted down to it.
Wait, pine school desk? You mean like the wooden chair with the arm shelf thing like we had in high school?
No, I mean, I don't think it was specifically a institutional school desk. It's got the tabletop, and then it's got a set off the side to hold books and things like that. And I'm trying to remember if it's got a hole underneath to throw books underneath the desktop. But yeah, it's a desk. I guess it isn't a school desk per se. It's just a regular desk.
Well, I am disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be cool. Well, though I don't know, the school desk that I had with a chair attached, those I don't know if those would hold up to bolting a press to them. Either way, David's right. Reloading is a whole lot of fun. And yeah, I just ended up buying one of the Lee anniversary reloading kits, which run for like, I think they're like up there. It was $100 when I bought mine. I think they're like $125 now. And it gives you a single stage press and not all the best stuff in the world, but enough to get you started. And then you might want to upgrade a thing here and a thing there. For better reloading, but you can get going and do everything that it's slow, but you can get it done. And it's a good way to start. And it's good to start slow.
Now, one thing that I hear a lot is that people find the act of reloading soothing and meditative, and that's great. But if you get too meditative, you can find your attention wandering. And the last thing you want to do is not be paying attention when you put the powder charge inside the cartridge, because that's how you get hot shots.
Yes. In one of the Handgun Radio episodes, Ryan Machad made a mention the fact that when he was down here in the armory, that he said, "I saw your reloading bench, your dust-covered reloading bench." Ever since I got a little girl, I have not reloaded a single round because, yeah, you don't want to get zoned out, and you don't want to get too distracted. I overall found that like I just would develop a rhythm. It was just all about a rhythm, and part of the rhythm was, you know, about every fifth round I would weigh a charge and just make sure everything was still running solid. And so yeah, you weigh a charge, you check your round as part of the rhythm, and that makes it so that even if you're super duper in the groove, if something falls out of spec, then suddenly you're immediately woken up and going, uh-oh, now what do I do? In this week's Tales from the Trunk, our friendly neighborhood trunk monkey records from the darkest depths of a discount tire store lobby to tell us more on how to give a good tale.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the next episode of Tales from the Trunk. I'm your friendly neighborhood trunk monkey. And this follow-up recording is being recorded from the lobby of a discount tire shop a few miles from Ninja HQ. I had a tire problem at the end of my day, and luckily I managed to get it inside, get it fixed, so I can be back out on the road tomorrow. Now, this is a follow-up to Aaron and Weird's commentary last week regarding vehicle pursuits and tails. So bear with me. There's going to be a little bit of background noise here while I'm sitting in a lobby swilling generic, you know, auto shop coffee. And so I'm going to reference things like parallel tails, which Weird mentioned, you know, which is very, very simple. You take a parallel street and you basically run side by side. The city of Detroit is really good for that because we have mile roads as markers going north and south. And then, of course, we have named roadways going... actually, I got that backwards. The mile roads run east-west, and the named roads go north-south. So you have roads like Greenfield, Evergreen, Wyoming, Shaner, Vernier, Harper, and then the various freeways that bisect the rest of the city. And then, of course, you have roads like Joy, Warren, 5 Mile, 6 Mile, McNichols, and the famous 8 Mile. As it stands, last week's episode was being recorded while I was doing the standard FBI box-style vehicle tail. That's where you basically box in your target. You have a lead car and a follow car. We did have a GPS device on the vehicle. And I still overshot my target, which is ironic. But yeah, apparently my tail is really nice looking, according to some people. I won't comment further on that. But the case did go well last week. Today's tail was very, very easy. A couple other things are just basically things I call things like falling off. It's when you have multiple units pursuing a vehicle. In order to change the tail, you might run a couple cars back
And then, you know, the lead tailing car will peel off down a side street, and then the secondary car will take up the primary position. And then, you know, you'll basically move into the next type of vehicle pursuit, which is leapfrogging, which can be used in conjunction with the box type pursuit or running parallel, you know, skipping ahead. A lot of times we have intelligence where we can land at a predetermined point if we know they've got an appointment somewhere or they're working or they have various other business that we can set up there. So people are none the wiser. And it works out pretty well for us. In terms of business news, I'll be opening another division starting December 1st. So business is really good. And business will actually be expanding after the first of the year, probably crossing state borders. So business is that good. In regards to other notes that I took... as a response to Aaron and Weird's commentary. That was about it, really. I guess the benefit of having tire problems is that I can sit and finish paperwork, so when I get home, I can just put my feet up. Today was rather anticlimactic in the field. You know, we were being warned of, I guess, Winter Storm Bruce, and it supposedly hit the western side of the state pretty hard last night and early. I was up with the elder dog about midnight, took her out, and it hadn't even started snowing yet. And the stuff that we've seen is just flurries that didn't stick. The winds being 20 to 30 miles an hour today probably didn't help. And as a comical aside, I was sitting in my truck today working. And I got approached by a neighbor, and ironically enough, that neighbor happened to be an investigator as well, worked for some small-time competition that I know of. I didn't allude to any sort of professional differences or anything else, but that person was a bit of a rookie, at least in terms of experience. The competition basically is not... any sort of competition for my firm, which is nice. But extended professional courtesy, misdirected her possible attention and curiosity because, well, you know, you don't trust nobody, nohow, at any time. And, well, I just preferred to be quiet. So, as it stands, hopefully the audio isn't too bad. Because, well, there's no road noise. I'm just sitting in an office. Well, a lobby of a Discount Tire. I'll probably be here for the next couple hours while Aaron and Weird record the podcast. So, as always, guys, stay safe, stay warm, and stay ninja.
So there. Now we know how to get some tail.
He records from... very exciting and exotic locales, doesn't he?
I love the ambiance of each and every one. It's, as I was listening to that one, there's, you may have noticed there was a lot of pee pops going on in there. I think because he was holding the recorder closer to his mouth so he could whisper and not have everybody hear the fact that there's a guy sitting in the corner of the tire warehouse talking to himself. But yeah, he gives us a different flavor every week, and I love it.
So here we have it. Trunk Monkey is our flavor of the week.
He is. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibrespodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the new ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at my nerd blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. I mostly edit bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, but occasionally I write something when I have the time. And of course, my two charity websites, blazingsword.org and pinkpistols.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
He prefers Hawaiian shirts. I like flowery sundresses. Our apparel styles are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.